The Athanasian Creed states that Christians, I quote, worship one God in Trinity, neither confounding the persons nor separating the essence. There is one person of the Father, another of the Son, and another of the Holy Spirit. The Father is God, the Son is God, and the Holy Spirit is God. And yet they are not three gods, but one God. Christian truth compels us to confess every person by himself to be God, and forbids us to say there are three gods. There are three persons. To say that there is only one would confound them. The is in the statement the Father is God is plausibly that of identity. Yet we're not allowed to infer that there are three gods. The Creed, in other words, seems to say that, and here are some statements on your handout, the Father is identical with God, the Son is identical with God, and the Holy Spirit is identical with God, and yet deny that Father, Son, and Spirit are identical, or that there are three gods. Yet it seems that one or the other must follow from these premises. The Creed, in other words, seems to preclude Christians being both orthodox and logically consistent. Some Christian thinkers have of late used the concept of constitution to try to deal with this. I think this won't do, and I'm now going to try and convince you of this, or at least say half of what I have to say that might convince you of it, as much as I have time for. I begin by explaining in general terms what constitution is supposed to be. I'll then lay out the best known version of constitution Trinitarianism, and I'll mostly discuss that, although I'll take a glance at one or two other proposals in that broad ballpark. Finally, I'll argue against these things. So first, constitution. Consider a lump of clay, lump, that gets molded into a statue, Athena. Lump existed before Athena. So they have different temporal properties. They also have different modal properties. Athena can't exist after Athena exists, but lump can exist after Athena exists. If Athena is crushed, there is no longer a statue, but there is still a lump of clay. Statues can't survive crushing, and lumps can. Lump is possibly lump-shaped. Athena is not. So, again, different modal properties. Objects which differ in property are not identical. So it seems that lump and Athena are not identical. But if so, there are, for a while, in the same place, two non-identical but completely coincident objects, a statue and a lump. It doesn't look like there are two things there. When lump is molded into Athena, lump doesn't suddenly get twice as heavy. So it would be nice if we could both acknowledge that lump and Athena are not identical, and yet give full scope to and explanation of the appearance that there are not two things there and our intuition that there are not two things there. That is what constitution is supposed to do. It is supposed to be a relation between lump and Athena while both exist. On many accounts, it is not identity, but it is a stronger relation than simple coincidence in place. And it's supposed to enable a good explanation of the appearance and intuition that just one object occupies the space Athena occupies. The combined force of the intuitions that favor distinct temporal and modal properties, and so two objects, and those favoring just one object per occupied spatial region, is supposed to drive us to posit a special relation, constitution, that lets us preserve all these intuitions. Some constitution theorists don't analyze this relation at all, treating it as primitive. Those who analyze it give many different accounts. The most carefully developed attempt to use constitution in an account of the Trinity is that of Michael Ray and Jeffrey Brouwer. They use a particular account of constitution. We need it before us to discuss their view. So, okay. One sort of intuition presses us to say that there is just one thing in the space Athena exactly occupies. For it looks like just one mass of matter fills that space. On the other hand, we have seen reason to say that two things are there. Brouwer and Ray suggest that we can say both consistently, thus preserving all our intuitions. Their basic claim is that though lump and Athena and Athena are not absolutely identical, they are, in a certain sense, one material object. What Brouwer and Ray want to say is this: when we count material objects, we legitimately count Athena and Lump together as just one object, even though they are two things, a statue and a lump. They are one material object, according to Brouwer and Ray, because they share all their material parts. Brouwer and Ray say this: just in case material things share all their material parts, they stand in a relation of what they call numerical sameness, being objects one in number, numbered together as one thing, even though they are, strictly speaking, distinct. Brouwer and Ray offer a number of definitions, but their key claim is this, and it's on your handout. X is a material object, just in case. X is a matter-form compound. Exactly one material object fills a region R, just in case at least one matter-form compound fills R. And X is numerically the same material object as Y, just if X and Y are form-matter compounds sharing the same matter. The notion of a matter-form compound is, of course, Aristotelian. The picture is that in any region R that's occupied by matter, there's going to be just one mass of matter. In the case of Athena and Lump, then, there's just one mass of matter in the region that Athena exactly occupies. But in that mass of matter, there are two forms, whatever exactly those are. One making the matter a statue, the other making the same matter a lump. Finally, X and Y are numerically the same, but not identical, just in case X and Y are a case of numerical sameness, but X is not identical with Y. Numerical sameness without identity is Brouwer and Ray's special constitution relation. So basically their idea is you've got a case of constitution wherever you've got one mass of matter in a region which is sharing, which has two forms in it. The consequence of there being two forms is that there are actually two material things there. The consequence of there being one mass of matter is that those two material things have all their parts in common. Brouwer and Ray may not actually need Aristotelian talk of form and matter. I think they could work as easily with a relation defined more simply, and this is also on your handout. X and Y are numerically the same just if X is a material object, Y is a material object, and the matter of X is identical with the matter of Y. And then you just add, for the constitution case, that's when X and Y are not identical. So that's their picture of constitution. Now, let me talk about how they apply this in thinking about the Trinity. Brouwer and Ray treat the Trinity in analogy with this. Father and Son and Spirit, for them, are three persons, and that, for them, is three immaterial analogs of matter-form compounds. The persons, Brouwer and Ray think, share something that plays the role of matter, but there are three forms in that something, making up three things. In parallel with the general account of constitution just quoted, Brouwer and Ray say the following, which is also on your handout. X is a god, just if X is a matter-form compound whose matter, in quotes, is some divine essence. X is the same god as Y, just if X and Y are form-matter compounds whose matter is some divine essence, and X's matter is the same as Y's matter. And there is exactly one God, just if there is an X, such that X is God, and every God is the same God as X. So the thought is, just as Athena and Lump share the same matter, but because they have two forms, they're going to be two objects. The persons share something which isn't material, but is playing the role of matter. And there are three forms in that something, and that makes up three person objects. Christopher Hughes once proposed a variant of this. His thought was, take the same basic picture, but say that the word God applies only to the one mass of divine, quote-unquote, matter, and say that the relation between person and God is not identity, but instead what he calls being materiated by, that is, having God as their matter. This, Hughes suggests, makes the relation between persons and God like that between a human with a divided mind and the plural centers of consciousness into which that mind divides. So one option for the constituting object is divine essence, whatever that's going to turn out to be. Hughes gives us a second option. Maybe it's God. There's one other option you could try and come up with, I think. You could suggest that the constituting object is the Father. At least that was once suggested to me. But I'm going to set this aside. It would be heretical. If the Father constituted Jesus, then the Father died on the cross, and that's a classic heresy. And we have not made sense of the creed unless we stay within the bounds of orthodoxy. That's one of the rules of the game. Now, in the full paper, I'm going to say quite a bit about the relation of constitution and why I'm rather skeptical that there is any such thing. But the paper sort of fit the time best if I cut all that out and read the rest. So just take it from me that I'm quite skeptical about constitution. Instead, what I'm going to focus on are what it is that makes up the persons, what does the constituting object, and some questions that arise out of that. So what is it that actually constitutes the person on the Brouwer and Ray view? Well, in the article where they set out their view together, they write, and I quote, "The role of matter in the case of the Trinity is played by immaterial stuff." They add, I quote again, "The matter of a thing is not an individual thing. Rather, it is that which combines with form to make an individual thing." If it's not an individual thing, then it's stuff. That's the other possibility. Obviously, they're thinking in terms of Aristotelian categories here. And if it's not a substance, it's the stuff that makes up a substance. They comment in a footnote that this, I quote, "view of matter seems to comport best with our view, with our solution to the problem of the Trinity." So it sounds like Brouwer and Ray believe in immaterial stuff. But they may not. In a personal note, Brouwer wrote to me, I quote, "I think of what plays the role of matter in God as a concrete individual, not as immaterial stuff. I thought this when Ray and I authored our joint piece, and I continue to think this now. I am not now, nor have I ever been a member of the Communist Party." In a solo piece expressing the Brouwer and Ray view, Ray is not forthcoming on what constitutes the persons. I quote, "What plays the role of matter in the Trinity is the divine nature, and it is a substance. Is it concrete or abstract, particular or universal, a property or something else? These questions I will not answer." Ray's insistence that it is a substance suggests at least a shift away from their apparent joint view that it's immaterial stuff. And there are things in Brouwer's note to me that suggest to me that maybe neither one of them ever actually believed that it was immaterial stuff. Let that be a letter to you about writing philosophy by committee. I mean, a lesson to you about writing philosophy by committee. Because they wound up publicly committed to a view that neither of them apparently ever held. Still, Brouwer and Ray did put the view on the table. Now, it's perfectly legitimate for Ray not to say what plays the matter role in his later piece. He means there to present only an abstract kind of view that can be developed in different ways, and that's a legitimate thing to do. But given all this, it seems particularly in place to consider the various ways we might treat the divine nature, the divine essence, the constituting whatever, in the Brouwer and Ray picture. Now, I'm just going to set aside the option that it's a property. Ray mentions it, but I can't really make any sense out of how a property is supposed to make up a person, particularly with the only other constituent being another property. That sounds like just magic to me. And, of course, there are bundle theories of substance, which say this is the truth with everything, but that just seems to sort of multiply the magic rather than solve, you know, explain anything. So I'm not going to take that seriously. And if you can't take the divine nature as a property, you must treat it instead as the concrete divine natural endowment. Now, what do I mean by that? Occam says somewhere that Peter's humanity is just Peter. Humanity is Peter's nature, that which makes the predicate human apply to him. Occam's idea, I think, is that what makes the predicate human apply to Peter is just all his concrete parts taken together, a particular sort of brain, lungs, legs, and so on. It's Peter's concrete, particular natural endowment that is what makes him human, and so it is his humanity for Occam. But this endowment just adds up to Peter. So it is also just Peter himself. And that's what Occam means when he says Peter is Peter's humanity. The same thing which is just concrete Peter is also the concrete natural endowment which makes the predicate human apply to Peter. We should think that it's that sort of divine nature that constitutes the persons for Brouwer and Ray. So here says there's a human natural endowment, lungs, legs, and so on. There's a divine natural endowment, which is concrete. And that, I think, is the constituting object in the Brouwer and Ray view best understood. Unlike human natural endowments, God's is unarticulated. It's not a matter of having many organs, parts, and so on. But beyond that, we must still ask, since Brouwer and Ray have raised the question, individual thing or stuff? However, no sooner do we ask this question than we need to rephrase it. What constitutes Athena is not clay, but a particular pound of clay. One can't count clay. One can count pounds of clay. A pound of clay is an individual. Clay, just clay full stop, is not. So what constitutes the persons, by analogy, has to be a particular quantity, for lack of a better word, of divine nature, an individual. The real question is whether stuff concepts can play any role in explicating the nature or function of this individual. In other words, just as it's a particular pound of clay that makes up Athena, it's got to be a particular something of divine essence that makes up the persons. Well, if we bring in stuff concepts at all, we must make sense of immaterial stuff. Aristotle and most Aristotelians thought that this could not be done, and so they treated immaterial substances as what they called pure forms. In effect, form-matter compounds minus the matter. We know how matter manages to make up substances because we know how matter takes on form and how we get it to do this. We mold clay into a statue. Taking advantage of its extension and plasticity, we physically impose a new shape. We chip marble into a statue. We take advantage of its brittleness, the weak bonds between some parts of it, to separate the statue from what surrounds it. In other words, we make a statue by moving some bits of marble away from other bits of marble. To combine chemical elements into a compound, we move some bits near other bits, and new causal links form between them. All of this depends on distinctively material aspects of matter. Shape, occupying space, having spatial relations, being divisible, having parts. We can use these distinctly material aspects of matter to give a think contentful explanation of matter's ability to constitute objects. All of these useful properties are absent with immaterial stuff. So if we ask how immaterial stuff is able to do the trick of making up an object, in other words, what properties of immaterial stuff make this possible, there is no answer. Subtract the distinctively matterish bits of the concept of matter, and nothing seems left over to make it a stuff save being non-individual when not partitioned into quantities, and the ability to constitute objects when combined with a form. But we don't know what partition or quantities can amount to in this case, save in the trivial sense that making up some objects might partition some immaterial stuff from other immaterial stuff, and the phrase one object's worth might be some sort of place marker for a quantity. Further, we have no explanation of how immaterial stuff can constitute an object or combine with a form. If so, the claim that divine essence is a stuff cannot tell us how divine essence can constitute objects. Without a thicker concept of what an immaterial stuff might be, the claim that there is one, and it's just what's needed to allow for immaterial constitution, is going to sound like hand waving. Again, an invocation of magic. But what else can there be to being an immaterial stuff? It doesn't come in quantities unless we call one person's worth a quantity. It's not divisible in any way we can grasp. It's not extended. It's not spatially related. Everything we understand about being a stuff goes with being material stuff. Subtract all that, and it's not clear what's left. Still, Brouwer and Ray need not treat a concrete divine nature as non-individual stuff. Masses of stuff typically divide into smaller quantities of stuff. When this is not so, with the minimum quantity, a single atom, we no longer have a mass of stuff. We have simply an individual. You've got a mass of water when you've got just a bunch of water in the glass. Take it down to its smallest part, one water molecule, that's no longer a mass of stuff. That's a thing. That's a molecule. An individual. If the divine natural endowment is a stuff, it's the smallest indivisible quantity of it. It is the atom of its kind. It is an individual thing. Quantities of stuff are individuals, including the smallest quantity. They're countable, not just weighable or measurable, when fully discrete and perhaps when not. So Brouwer and Ray should treat the divine essence as an individual, a substance. Even if one wanted to go the stuff route, just following out the logic of stuff concepts would lead you in the end to the idea that this is not a stuff. It's an individual thing, which is the smallest quantity of a stuff. Thus, the only way I think to parse their picture is to say this. The persons have a concrete individual in common. But without the matterish bits of the concept of this concrete individual, what understanding does talk of constitution really yield in the Trinitarian case? If you can't use talk of constitution to talk about literally being molded, literally taking on a shape, that sort of thing, what do you actually get by talking about constitution here? I'd like to suggest that it's little more than a very distant analogy, structurally, to what might be going on in the Trinity, and it's an analogy which is precisely undercut by the immaterial nature of what you're talking about. So it might very well be that there's really nothing distinctively left to think about here once you've actually realized what you've taken out of the concept of matter to lead yourself with an immaterial atom of something. William Hasker has gone the concrete individual as constituting object route in his own constitution account. Hasker calls the shared individual the divine soul. I want to look at that for a bit. Hasker's move comes at a price. For one thing, we now have another sort of concrete divine individual, the divine soul. Hasker doesn't actually use the same theory of constitution Brouwer and Ray do, but if we just stay with Brouwer and Ray for the moment, this thing will be the same immaterial object as the persons, but it's not a person. Instead, it's the soul of the divine persons. We had not suspected that a spirit could have a soul. What do you know? God does. The divine soul isn't divine the way a person is or the way God is on Hasker's picture. but it is at least divine the way a human bone is human. It's a constituent that helps make up a divine person, as bones help make up human persons. That's trouble. If we can venerate parts of saints sensibly, a fortiori we could venerate this constituent of God sensibly. And if we do, we should venerate it a lot more than part or even all of a saint. There should not be something other than God or a person that can get a distinctively divine level veneration. I think there's even more trouble here. I would not ordinarily thank your bones if you help me, but I can be glad that they are there and are firm if you use your bones to pick me up out of quicksand. Similarly, then, I could be very glad that the divine soul is there if God saves me. It's not a person, and if that entails that it can't understand me, I can't sensibly thank it. But I can imagine a liturgy that runs this way. Rejoice in the divine natural endowment, the divine soul, mighty and powerful. Without it, there would be no God. It is great. Look at the marvelous attributes it gives God. It is holy. It is the inmost core of the holiest being. It is mighty. All God's power comes from it. By making God what he is, it is the ultimate source of all good things. Amen. If the fact that the soul is not a person entails that it cannot understand us, we could not properly understand what we were doing in reciting this liturgy and mean to be worshiping. Worship addresses something with the point of being understood by that something, and we cannot sensibly address in this way what cannot understand us. But intoning that liturgy is close enough to worship that it should make us uncomfortable. And perhaps the divine soul can hear us in and through the persons hearing us. After all, if you have a soul and you hear me, I might be inclined to say that your soul is also hearing me in a sense. And again, I touch the marble lump by touching the statue. If so, the line between reciting that liturgy and worship becomes vanishingly thin. That tells us that believing in a divine soul is enough like believing in a fully divine entity distinct from God or any person that it should make us uncomfortable. For being divine just does go with deserving worship. Let me expand on a line from the Liturgy of the Soul. Brouwer and Ray rightly want there to be nothing in reality that is in any sense prior to or deeper than God. But if we let the divine essence, the divine matter, exist with its own positive being as an atom of stuff, it is a positive being that is the foundation of the persons, and in a different sense that I'll make clear of God. In a clear sense, on this picture, the most basic thing in reality is not God, but the chunk of stuff he's made of. God is not the most fundamental thing. The divine essence is. This just seems wrong to me, as I suspect it does to Brouwer and Ray. And the idea that there's something wrong with this is very widespread within classical theism. It's a big motive for people's adopting the doctrine of divine simplicity, which was held largely to avoid just this sort of consequence. Okay, so Hasker's version of constitution is not quite the same as Brouwer and Ray's, but it has its own set of problems. On Hugh's variation on the Brouwer and Ray picture, the divine soul just is God. That obviates the worship problem. God hears us on his variant through the person's hearing, as someone with a divided mind hears through the mind's hearing. Worship of the soul is worship of God, and that's just fine. But then we have another problem. The relation between God and the persons is constitution, not identity. It's being materiated by, not identity. So God and the persons, on the Hughes variation, add up to four individuals, not three. Does God the soul, God the constituting object, have the divine nature? Well, the soul is numerically the same with the divine nature on Brouwer and Ray's account, and a person's numerical sameness with the divine nature is, for Brouwer and Ray, what accounts for the person's having the divine nature. So it seems that God, the constituting object, will have the divine nature on this picture. If so, then we have four divine individuals, quaternity, not trinity. But if God, the constituting object, does not have the divine nature, God is not divine. And how could that be? An answer might be that God is not divine the way persons are, but instead the way human bones are human. But then we have two ways of being divine, primary and derivative. And it turns out that God is only derivatively a deity. God has only second-class deity. He's human in the sense, you know, your bones are human because they're the bones of a human being. God turns out to be the constituting object that's divine because it's the constituting object of a divine person. How could God be a second-class deity? Hume's switch to God as constituting object avoids the problem of having a divine nature that's deeper than God, for God is the foundation of reality on this picture. But then, God is the ground of the persons. They are materiated by God, and so they are derivative objects. They exist not a se, but a God. And so one has to wonder, are they fully divine, or are they only second-class divine, since they lack the key property of absolute aseity? Hasker has a final variation on the relation between the constituting object and God. For Hasker, as we've seen, the constituting object is not God, but the divine soul. Hasker adds that the proper referent of the term God is the entire Trinity. The Trinity can be strictly and properly called God. Now, just two points about that. One, that entails that God is not an I. God is a we, or an it. I think there are a lot of problems with that idea, and I've laid out some of them in an old paper of mine called Antisocial Trinitarianism. I'll note here that the claim that God can only be properly used for the whole Trinity seems to clash with some of the ways God is used in the New Testament. Jesus uses Father and God interchangeably. He was not referring to the whole Trinity by doing so. At the end of John, Thomas refers to Jesus as God. He does not get a lecture on how to properly use the term God for the Trinity. He seems to have the usage accepted. So Hasker's prescription for how we should use the word God doesn't seem to fit with the biblical phenomenon, and that's another problem with Hasker's overall view. Finally, on any orthodox account of the Trinity, God is triune by nature, not by accident or deliberate choice. If this is so on Hasker's view, then it's the nature of the divine soul to generate a Trinity. The divine soul, by its nature, gives rise to the three persons. If that's so, the nature generates the persons, and so the whole of God, making the nature the ultimate reality in an even thicker sense than we've contemplated so far. It's bad enough to have something lie deeper in reality than God, but should something generate God? And notice the reason I say that is, for Hasker, you've got the divine soul generates the persons, and it's only when you've got the persons that you've got something that adds up to God. So it is literally true that you've got something generating God on Hasker's version of constitution Trinitarianism. So I've considered the constituting object and the referent of the term God in three variations on constitution Trinitarianism, and I've raised a variety of problems for each version of them. I now want to talk about the classification of constitution Trinitarianism. I have elsewhere distinguished two Trinitarian projects. Both are, in effect, efforts at conceptual construction. One is this. Starting with three divine persons, explain how they managed to be just one God. Some Greek patristic writers clearly tried this. In my own writing on the Trinity, I've called this project social Trinitarianism, because many on this side of the aisle use social analogies in trying to explain the oneness of God. Another project constructs in the opposite direction. The project is this: starting with one God, explain how there are distinct persons. This is pretty clearly the project medieval Latin theologians like Aquinas pursued. In Aquinas, we get 26 questions on God as one before the Trinity enters the scene. and the persons are explained in terms of relations God as one bears to God as one. That is in direct dissent from Augustine. So I've called this project Latin Trinitarianism, or LT. As the acronym LT names a project, not a geographic description, Greek writers could perfectly well engage in it. I'm not trying to say that there was some East-West split in Trinitarianism, or that if you wrote in Greek or if you wrote in Latin, that made a difference to your view. I'm just saying that there are two projects, and it's a convenient way to designate the projects. There clearly are two projects here, and it's also clear that some historical Trinitarians pursued each. Michael Ray says that Constitution views, quote, transcend the divide between LT and ST. I disagree, at least on my understanding of these terms. Hughes, for example, has a Constitution Trinitarianism that I think is pretty clearly Latin. He starts out with God as the constituting object and explains how you get the persons from that. I think Brouwer and Ray belong on the ST side of the divide. On their view, the persons each have the full divine, concrete, natural endowment. There is one God only because they share it. If per impossibile there were just one person, he would be the one God on the Brouwer-Ray view, the one thing with that endowment. As there are three persons, there is for Brouwer and Ray one God because they share the concrete, divine, natural endowment. In other words, one God is constructed by the overlap of the persons. There is one God because there are the three persons and they have their matter in common. Facts about how many gods there are and the unity of the one God in three persons derive from facts about the persons for Brouwer and Ray. So, Brouwer and Ray's constitutionalism executes the social Trinitarian project. Though in other senses, it is not socialist, e.g. it does not take social analogies as its primary way of understanding the unity of the persons. I tend to think that versions of ST have monotheism problems, and I think that's true for Brouwer and Ray. Theirs emerge when they discuss the following argument, which is on your handout. 1, Father equals God. 2, Son equals God. 3, it is not the case that Father equals Son, but 4, Father equals Son, following from 1 and 2 by transitivity, and of course, conjoined and you got a contradiction. Now, we can avoid 4 and so avoid the contradiction only by either denying a premise or blocking the inference. But 1 through 3 look like plausible renderings of standard Trinitarian doctrine. So denying a premise should not be our first thought. Brouwer and Ray instead try to block the inference. Now, transitivity of identity gets us to 4 only if the word God refers to the same thing in premises 1 and 2. Brouwer and Ray deny this. Rather, they say, the word God is ambiguous in 1 and 2. I quote, I think it's on your handout. The Father is identical with God, the Son is identical with God, and yet the Father and Son are distinct. Consider a parallel. Athena is identical with the material object in R. Lump is identical to the material object in God in R. But Athena is distinct from Lump. Since the phrase the material object in R is ambiguous, there is no threat of contradiction. Likewise in the case of the Trinity. Now the parallel argument is also given on your handout. 5, Athena equals the material object in R. 6, Lump equals the material object in R. 7, it is not the case that Lump equals Athena. 8, Lump equals Athena by transitivity. The ambiguity Brouwer and Ray are claiming in this second argument is this. They say that in 5, the phrase the material object in R refers to Athena, while in 6, the phrase refers to Lump. If that's true, 5 and 6 do not entail 8, and so the contradiction is averted. In parallel, they want to say, in the original argument, premise one, God refers only to the Father. In premise two, God refers only to the Son. Contradiction averted, if it works. But does it work, and at what price? Well, let's think about that for a minute. The word God is a singular term. Let's suppose first that it's a million name, a proper name without a sense. There's only one way for a million name to be ambiguous. And that's the way the name Brian is ambiguous between Leftow and Leiter. The ambiguity arises because a million name's meaning is its referent, and it has different referents when used of Leiter and of Leftow. So that's how you explain the ambiguity if the word God is a million name. Suppose, on the other hand, that the word God is a covert definite description, or perhaps a name with some sort of definite description as its sense. That would make the parallel between 1 and 2 and 5 and 6 a bit closer. So let's say that the word God really amounts to the phrase, the being which includes the divine natural endowment. This description has the same sense in 1 and 2 in that case. Its ambiguity then must arise at the level of reference. It picks out a different person in each case. So, if you can get an ambiguity out of this, on this parsing, it's explained just as the ambiguity is explained if the word God is a million name, namely, its ambiguity due to difference in referent. Now, just parenthetically, you really can make this work as an ambiguity only if you claim that there's some kind of context relativity, so that in one, somehow the reference goes only to the Father, and two, only to the Son. A natural thought would be that you've just got one definite description, the being which includes the divine natural endowment. And since on Brouwer and Ray's account there are three such beings, it just simply shouldn't refer at all. But so I'm inclined to think that maybe you just can't make a go of this with definite descriptions. But that's okay. You can still treat the word God as a million name and still execute their general strategy. If that's how things are, then no matter whether the word God is a name or if it's a description and you can make this work with a description, then just as with Leiter and Leftow we have two Brians, in the Trinity we have three gods, three distinct individuals the singular term God can pick out, each as fully one God as Leiter and I are fully one Brian. Having the same concrete natural endowment doesn't block the point. It is compatible with the persons sharing their so-called matter. If Leiter and I were Siamese twins sharing everything but our heads, my treatment of he and I would still be correct. It would also still be correct if we were somehow distinct but wholly coincident, which, Lord forbid. So it seems that on the Brouwer and Ray view, the persons are three gods in the way Leiter and I are two humans, which is as good a statement of tritheism as one could wish. I'm puzzled as to how we are to explain Brouwer and Ray's ambiguity of the word God without implying tritheism. But without the ambiguity of the word God, they have no way to block the argument they're trying to deal with. Now, one might reply that using the word God in this way is just standard Trinitarianism. As I mentioned, Jesus often uses Father and God interchangeably, and at the end of John, Thomas addresses Jesus as God and is not reproved. So that the word God names persons is part of the phenomena theories of the Trinity have to save. If the phenomena aren't tritheist, one might say, why are Brouwer and Ray tritheist? I reply that different metaphysical pictures can save the same phenomena, and they have different implications when doing so. On modalism, for instance, the word God names both Father and Son because the one God switches roles. The term isn't ambiguous. It always names the same individual, and so monotheism is secure. On my own account of the Trinity, the word God also always names the one God unambiguously. But he doesn't switch roles. Instead, he always plays all three person roles in three parts of his life which are running simultaneously. My view is like modalism in being monotheist, but makes the distinction between the persons eternal, necessary, and intrinsic, thus remaining orthodox. Why do I mention these things? Apart, of course, from a bit of self-advertisement. While it is part of the phenomena that the word God names individual persons, it is not part of the phenomena that the word God is ambiguous. That's the contribution that is distinctive to Brouwer and Ray's account of the phenomena, and it's that contribution, I've argued, that gets us into trouble. Another way to see the tritheism problem is to ask whether the one God has a mind for Brouwer and Ray. The only minds in their pictures seem to be the persons. There is no fourth divine mind, as should be so. But just for this reason, for them, the one God seems to lack mental properties. The one God can't be omniscient if it is not the kind of thing to have knowledge at all. We might, I guess, say that just as the persons are all one God by sharing a natural endowment, they have one mind to the extent that their thoughts overlap, but in my view, that's stretching things. There isn't any one thing with the thoughts of the one God on Brouwer and Ray's picture. There are just three things, each with his own thoughts, each with his own mind, each as much a separate omniscient God as Leiter and I are a separate non-omniscient Bryans. So Brouwer and Ray, I think, do end up with three gods, which is just what the Athanasian Creed forbids. Other versions of Constitution Trinitarianism I've tried to suggest briefly have other problems of other sorts. So overall, while there is rather more to be said about this broad approach, and there are Constitution accounts that I have not discussed, I want to suggest it doesn't look like a promising way to go.